I'm here with Shuddha Parbiswas at the Cafe Gallery in Southwark Park. I'd like to start by talking to you about your installations here, and in particular Birdsong. Can we begin by just talking through that work, its conception, the way that you've installed it here, and also about the background to do with the piece?
Yes, I started thinking about the piece almost 4 years ago when my son, Enzo, began to speak. And in fact, one of the first conversations I had with him, he articulated, "Mummy, I would like to have a horse." And I said, "Well, where are we going to have a horse?" Because we lived in a flat at the time. And he said, "I'd like it to live in my living room." And it was just this quite extraordinary moment for me. The idea of the child's imagination and the idea of how for him it was so possible that he could quite happily share that space with this horse. And he often talked about it. It sort of motivated me. You know, the more kind of ridiculous it felt, the more I felt I wanted to achieve it. So that's really the starting point. And around the same time, of course, I'd been very drawn to a painting by Stubbs. It's Lord Holland and Lord Albemarle shooting at Goodwood, and it's painted in 1759. And I have a wonderful book on the work of Stubbs, and there's a detail of this black manservant's face. And whenever I look at it, I just thought, well, this is not one of subservience. This is not one that represents that usual or familiar equation, especially at that particular period in history, which is the kind of master-slave relationship or equation. You know, this man wants to be somewhere else, and he's looking beyond some plane. And of course, when my son Enzo came up with this statement, it just really transported me to the expression on this particular, you know, manservant's face in Stubbs's painting. I mean, I think as an artist, it's always very hard to distill exactly which influences take you at any particular moment, because you can't pretend that you've not been educated in a very, very art history heavy department, if you like, you know, at the University of Leeds, where I studied under Griselda Pollock, John Tagg, Fred Orton, and of course under the auspices of a department that was established by Tim Clark. So I had a total love of art history, still do, you know. And then, of course, my father died, which is, you know, we were very close. And when he died, I began to revisit Proust, in particular Swan's Way, Remembrance of Things Past, so began to filter into the work because of the way in which Proust measures time by light and by space and literally by the process of remembering, if you like. All these things, I think, are really fascinatingly interconnected, and for me had a very, very clear resonance in how the work came about.
We start in the work, it's a double screen projection, and we start by seeing an origami winged horse that is gently spinning on some string, and then we move very gently, really, through a series of four scenarios or painterly visions. And I just wanted to start by talking about that place that you've evoked of the reality and the remembered horse, the horse of your son's imagination, and then the horse in reality, which he then is in front of. And just a little bit about that and the little paper horse as well, the origami horse, if we could talk about that.
Yes, absolutely. I liked the dichotomy, if you like, between the imagined, you know, the origami horse represents the imagined world. I liked textually, formally and aesthetically, you know, intellectually, the difference in the spaces the two things occupy, the physicality of the real beast, the horse, and the lightness, if you like, and the playfulness of this origami paper winged horse.
So then we have a space and the scenario changes. Then we actually see your son sitting in a room looking quite extraordinary. I mean, if we can just talk about that look, which so captures a little moment of what he's thinking and as the audience were drawn into his gaze very particularly, and we're not quite sure what he's looking at. And then it becomes clear. So just about that way that you're leading us on a journey to connect between his imagined world and now the reality of here is the horse.
Exactly, yeah. So in terms of the look, it was something that I had in my mind's eye as to how close I wanted that shot to be. Quite close up, really. The shot comes up, you see the young boy's face. It's a particular time of day between 10 and about 11 in the morning when the light is very gentle and very particular. And the way that the light falls onto Enzo's face has all those kinds of qualities, if you like, and takes us into that world of both real and imaginary, you know, takes us to a distant place. And of course, to move from the winged horse into that moment then draws you to the real space, to the real world. And you don't, as you quite rightly say, immediately recognise or know that this is the context of a living room, if you like, that there is a horse there, until the body of the horse comes into focus. I think the dichotomy between those two things, that this is the imagined space, and then suddenly you've got this great huge beast that's there, and you think, my God, this is real. And it is the making of the impossible. That's something that's quite a fantastic moment.
The camera angle and shot is very interesting because the sun is sitting incredibly still. There's one point where you see the horse's bridle hanging down, and you suddenly see your son's hair just lift for a second, and his eyes slightly look like this is a very big horse and it's very close. And there's that lovely moment of kind of tension where we as viewer realise that actually there's a real horse in front of him, and he realises as well, very obviously, oh goodness, it's a real horse. You absolutely know you're looking at the real. You know this is the real emotion in real time happening, and you can't make that up.
No. But also, I was absolutely petrified. I thought, my God, you know, I have to be so calm here. This is my son, and if that horse bolts, we could have a fatality on our hand. And for me, the work engages with that sense of trust, you know, and that sense of total and utter fear that one has with the thing and the person that you love. But it was also about maybe confronting fear, confronting death, if you like it, and confronting life, actually, because that's quite fearful too, isn't it?
I'd also like to talk about the setting, because you had to source that, and that wasn't very easy because, as you pointed out in an interview in the catalogue, trying to persuade somebody to put a horse in a rather grand living room was always going to be slightly problematic. Mm-hmm. So can we talk a little bit about the setting, and then of course we move to the next shot in your film where we actually see the living room.
Yeah, I mean, it was very hard. We just went through a location finder. I mean, I worked with Film and Video Umbrella, who were just incredibly, and also Innova, but Film and Video Umbrella, because of the experience that they have in terms of working within film production. You know, as you say, it was hell trying to find somebody who'd volunteer their living room. So eventually we found a wonderful 1930s, almost deco building that a property developer had bought. Sadly, it's going to be pulled down to erect more lucrative flats, I guess, that he'll rent out. But it's a beautiful building, and because it was more or less derelict, I mean, that room is in a dreadful state, we had to literally carpet it, underline the carpet in case, of course, the horse did something. And we wanted very much to create an authentic feel of a room that could belong to one's grandparents. And it's quite a bourgeois room, really. You know, it's something kind of comfortable and uncomfortable about it at the same time. We matched the colour scheme to the colours and the hue of the Stubbs painting that we talked about earlier.
The shot where you see your son on the sofa is interesting because suddenly when we're closely looking at his face, scrutinising his gaze, and then we see the horse kind of move across, and still not quite sure what it is at that point, that it is a large horse. Then in the shot where you pull out and we've got the living room, your son looks so small. He's kind of in this pool of light going across him. It's very particular. The horse is very still, so it becomes like this stilled moment in the painting, apart from a little flick here and there. But it's a very, very still horse, swaps into a painting this extended time. Then you finish the sequence, because it's just over 9 minutes long, going back to the mobile. I think that's very interesting as well, because then we're taken back into the possibility of his imagination continuing back to something more containable.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of how we edited it, one of the things that the final sort of edit, if you like, the two projections, functions is very specifically to play with a sense of that time, because there's a tiny, I think it's something like 25 to 30 frames difference between the first image on the right and the second image. Effectively, they're the same image, but there's a slight time delay, which emphasises the idea of double take. But it's also something about the imagination, the point at which you hear something and the point at which there's cognition, if you like. And of course, returning in the final shot to the winged horse again, they're like bookends. They announce it and then they complete the story. The final edit of the mobile actually is of a different length than the beginning. So we stop it before it slows down. And I think it's that sense of the story coming to a conclusion, but not quite.
Am I right in saying you shot this on 16mm?
Yes. It was really important to me to work on 16mm format. There were two cameras in that space, and we shot exactly the same time. In other words, the film was synchronised in that way, with the same image being shot at the same time, but from two different sort of vantage points, if you like, and distances. And I think there's something about 16mm film which is so saturated with colour. You know, there's something so painterly and exquisite about that. That was why it shot on 16mm film. But also because of that kind of history with cinema and the cinematic moment and the cinematic experience. It is, you know, straightforwardly being transferred onto DVD, so one could argue, well, you've lost that a little bit because of this. But, you know, I don't really feel that, actually. I think that the essence of it being shot on a particular format gives you a wealth of experience and information that you wouldn't really, I don't think, have gotten on shooting it even on high-end digital. And there's a kind of rhythm to film. Very different fluctuation in the light, and you do get a little bit of dropout here and there, and you get this slight sort of spangled moment that have no rationale. And yet it's exactly that lack of rationale which I think is so magical, you know, so wonderful.
I also wanted to talk about the relationship in your work between silence and sound, because in your exhibition, you've got one piece which has sound. The piece we're discussing now is silent.
I do use silence often in my video and more recently in the film work. And I think the very simple reason is the sense of deafening through silence. You know, you do feel that even without sound, it can be quite deafening, because you immediately bring your own knowledge of sound, the sound of a horse snorting and all those kinds of things, or movement, the rustle of something. And then, so to take it away in this piece seemed to make it more noisy for me than to have it there. It also allows the space of imagination. I wanted to create something that really made you catch your breath because of the space it gave you as a viewer in experiencing it at that particular moment in time, really.